Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in a series of retro spoiler specials. And this one, like our Love Actually spoiler special, is Christmassy tinged and arrives wrapped in a bow and a lovely ribbon, just like Frank Shirley, just in time for the festive season. Because we are talking today about one of my favorite Christmas movies of all time, and in fact, one of my favorite movies of all time, arguably the best in the Vacation series. It is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Oh yes, indeed. And joining me to discuss this over the next hour or so are two of my finest festive colleagues of such lethal cunning, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And Nick Desemlian.
Eat my road, red liver lips. It's the red that gets me. Like, why red liver lips? It's very specific.
Do livers have lips? Are these lips like livers?
You don't want to go near like brown liver lips. Yeah. That would be unpleasant.
But livers are kind of brownish, aren't they?
It's very interesting.
Well, thank you for joining us on this spoiler special. There we go. We really got to the nitty-gritty of this movie. But yes, indeed. I love Christmas Vacation. I always have, ever first I since saw it when I was a young bairn back in Northern Ireland. And so I knew one day I would talk about it with two people on a podcast to herald the Christmas season. But I also thought to myself one day, that I would get to talk to the film's director, Jeremiah S. Chechik, on a podcast. Yes, indeed. Those are dreams I've harbored since I was a child. And this week, that came true, for I caught up with Jeremiah S. Chechik, for that is his name, on the Dread Zoom, but I think the sound quality is pretty good in this one. And we had a good old natter, spoiler-filled and otherwise, just general recollections, really, about his time directing this movie. What a way to make your feature debut. Here we go. Before we get into it, here is Jeremiah S. Chechik talking about National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Do please enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on this retro spoiler special for National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, or as it is known over here apparently now, National Lampoon's Winter Holiday, by the film's director, Jeremiah S. Chechik. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm okay. I could tell by...
Under these conditions, we're walking and talking, we're lucky.
We are indeed. We are indeed. I could tell by your raised eyebrows there whenever I said National Lampoon's Winter Holiday that was new information for you. In fairness, it was new information for me about a week ago.
It is new. It is new. I've never heard that or seen it or anything.
No one tells the director anything.
No. No, I mean, why change the title now? It's just bizarre. But okay.
But the point is, the film remains the same, and this is a film I've adored ever since I first saw it. And I imagine we just spoke there before I started press and record. We spoke there about how often this movie comes up for you with every passing year, and it becomes more of a thing. It seems to be now heralded as a modern Christmas classic. Is that must blow your mind?
Yes, it certainly does. Blows my mind. Yeah. When we set out to make it, at that time in my particular kind of adventure in directing, I had been doing commercials. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of known for long lens, fast cutting, very sexy, monochrome, beautiful light, that kind of hipster, commercials at that time. So when I got this movie, I had to really restrain myself in terms of my visual language and really refer back to a classicist approach of, Currier and Ives or Norman Rockwell, sort of a mythos of Americana visuals. And so I restrained myself in that way and tried to make as many decisions that were at least inviting the film to last a little bit longer than what was hip at the moment. Mm. One never expects it to achieve, I don't know, 30 years. So it's as much of a surprise to me as the many who've enjoyed it. It's not that I see it very often, because I don't. I did see it when it opened. I didn't see it for a really long time, maybe about 20, well, maybe about 15 years ago, there was a screening at the American Cinematheque, and that was just kind of fully loaded and interesting, and I answered a lot of questions there. And then recently, I managed to take my granddaughter when it screened in theaters. That was really excited, and that was really the first time I thought I experienced the movie a little more objectively, mm-hmm. and I thought it was funny.
It is. It's very funny. And I have to say as well, watching it over the years, because when I first saw it, I was, I don't want to age myself here, Jeremiah, but I was just started my teenage adventure, should we just say that? And I was obviously focusing on the more slapstick element of the movie, the sled that suddenly rockets down the hill at 1,000 miles an hour, Clark falling off a ladder, the business with the lights. I focus on all that stuff, and as I've been watching it more and more, I watch it every single year, and I find myself gravitating towards the quieter stuff, the more heartfelt stuff that maybe it was always been there, but I maybe missed it and overlooked it first time around. But it's always been there.
Well, certainly for me, John wrote a beautiful script, and John Hughes had mm-hmm. a real kind of connection to a certain kind of iconic sentimentality, shall we call it, or emotionalism, as mm-hmm. in the best possible way. And it was my absolute focus in making the movie. Because I had never made a comedy. I'd never made a movie before, but I certainly wasn't what I would consider experienced in terms of comedic direction. I literally just felt, well, if I think it's funny, maybe there's one other person on earth who would find it funny. I'll start there. But my focus as a director was to really land and drill down on those emotional moments, because I thought, despite how broad the characters are, or despite the kind of slapstick element of the comedy, if one lands the emotive quality, if that is the hook that the audiences are going to use to follow a sort of every man's journey into trying to do what he believes is right, even at the expense of destroying everything around him. And so those little moments where we really get to experience the feeling of the interior and frustration and eventual, we can call it a triumph of some description, that really holds one's attention. In fact, in the very first public screening of the film, when we were just previewing it for audiences, and I was, of course, terrified. It being my first movie, and thought, well, if this doesn't go well, that's the end of this career.
Yeah.
And I was sitting next to the head of the studio, Terry Semel, which made it even more kind of starkly pressured. But so we were sitting next to each other and just in the middle of the audience, just experienced the movie. Was playing very well. People were laughing. But I, of course, said, yeah, they're laughing now. Wait till the end of the movie. They're going to hate it. They'll walk away. But at some point in the movie, it was when Clark was trying to plug in those lights, that scene where he really builds it up and drum roll and the family's around and go for it, Clark. And everybody is there. And the audience got really, really quiet. And he jammed these plugs together and nothing happens. But at that moment, the entire preview audience just went, oh, they just like groaned. And at that very moment, I turned to Terry Sella, who was, like I said, the head of Warner's. Yes. And we looked at each other and we knew this movie was going to be successful. And I felt it because of that moment, not because of the jokes, but because I said, oh, my God, the audience is really with this character, as cartoony, as broad, as crazy as he is. The audience feels his pain, his frustration. And yeah. So those emotional moments were very important.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's really interesting, for example, that this is the rare vacation movie that gives Clark an unvarnished win. Yes, he goes through an awful lot of bad shit in order to get to the win at the end. But the last line of the movie is him you know, feeling content. And the last line of the movie is him saying, "I did it."
Yeah,
and I love that. I really, really love that. Was that always how the movie ended? In your recollection?
Yeah, there were some adjustments I remember making in the final mix. John was in Chicago doing Uncle Buck, I think, at the time. Mm. And you know, the studio was very confident because the previews had gone very well, and John was very happy. They had just left, you know, this first time director in charge of a big studio movie to do what it is he wanted to do, and so I did it. I made some adjustments at the end, but that was the operative focus, is just for him to have accomplished what he set out to be. Then it, you know, the movie lands. There's a reason we watched it, went through all of that. So
yeah,
there you go.
How much of a bearing on this movie did the previous two vacation movies at that point have? I guess for Chevy and Beverly in particular, having played these characters twice before, it would have had an impact. But it strikes me in a way that this is a movie that doesn't really pay attention to the fact that there were two previous vacation movies. So you could watch this one as a standalone. Is that how you approached it?
Well, I approached it just the way you described, aggressively. You know, I've never seen the first two movies.
Have you seen them now?
No. No, I haven't. You know, I'm not doing it to kind of be difficult.
Of course.
But the movie was based on a short story, Christmas 59, I believe it was called. You know, John Hughes wrote for the Harvard Lampoon. He was an extraordinarily gifted writer. And, you know, I did feel that he had taken this short story, he had made a script of it. It wasn't the kind of script that would be naturally a vacation movie with Chevy. Mm-hmm. This could have been a classic soup to nuts Christmas movie with a new cast, etc. I'm not sure if Warner Brothers had pushed him in that direction to do it. To, you know, fold it into what then was kind of a teetering franchise. But he did. And I approached it in the same way that I think he wrote the story. I just wanted to make a standalone movie. Of course, you know, probably my ego was very much involved. And I don't say probably. Absolutely. You know what I mean? I did want it to kind of sow my own oats, lay down my own kind of markers, and make my own movie, even if I was operating under the illusion that it was an original movie. And so I did everything I could to avoid kind of drafting the first two movies. So I purposely didn't watch them. They weren't the kind of movies that I would have been watching anyway at the time. So, you know, my process was very much to create a standalone movie. The characters, yes, they had played those characters before. I didn't address it. I mean, they took my direction for the most part. Beverly resisted for a long time.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think Beverly was frustrated at that point doing that kind of work. Because Beverly is, she's a really great actress, dramatic and comedic. And you know, you're in some ways, actors will know this, you're kind of stuck in a franchise. It's good and bad, you know. You have a continuity of work, good paydays, etc. You know the characters. I mean, we feel less about it now because of television, where an actor will come and play a character evolving. It could be for years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
But you know, at that point, I just tried to cast around them because, you know, the kind of supporting cast, the kids, were all cast by me. And so that was a way to keep it fresh. And, you know, I just approached it as characters. I mean, they knew the internal kind of comedic rhythms. Certainly, I wasn't going to teach them that. But, you know, the kind of, I think that tension between an original film and the way it was marketed as part of the vacation triple threat at that time just served the movie well, open to an audience, and had, as I recall, I think it was number one for like 4 weeks, which I didn't know. I thought, oh, yeah, that's good. That's natural. I had no idea. That's unusual.
Yeah, very much. Now, right? Especially now, my God, yeah. Well, I mean, nowadays, you can, of course, you could be number one with a movie that makes, you know, $5. You'd be okay. But
exactly.
Yeah, but back then, it was slightly different. But it's interesting that you bring up, you know, Beverly and Chevy's performances. And Beverly, I guess, is very much... She's very much the voice of reason in this, whereas Clark is the comedic spark of the movie. And working with Chevy to get that performance, I mean, there, you know, obviously there's been, you know, all sorts of talk over the years about how Chevy can sometimes be difficult to work with. I've spoken to you about this movie before, and you told me that he was a dream to work with on this one.
He was great, yeah. Yeah, because I think he wanted me to direct it. So obviously... I think, you know, John wanted me to do it. I think I was the second choice as director. Chris Columbus was discussed. I think Chevy did not want him to direct it. That was to my benefit. Mm. And I'm not sure they got along. And Chris, you know, being the talent that he is, you know, went on to make fantastic movies, so it was to his benefit too. But Chevy wanted me to do it, and you know, John wanted me to do it, and the studio wanted me to do it. So I felt supported the whole way. Mm. Any kind of tensions I had with Beverly, I didn't mind them, because I just thought this is part of directing too, just working through that. Mm-hmm. All the, you know, Diane Ladd, Doris Roberts, E.G. Marshall, mm-hmm. you know, John Randolph, Johnny Galecki, of course, and Juliet. You know, these were actors, all of them really, really solid. I mean, look at Johnny Galecki. I mean, who would have predicted that he would be one of the highest paid actors in Hollywood? I love him for it. You know, I see him once in a while at Warner's, and you know, deservedly so. And all those great character actors who really, in a way, and I told them, you know, come to my rescue if I'm acting like a douche, if I don't know what I'm doing, just circle me and straighten me out. But, you know, they were very, very supportive. And of course, you know, all tributes to John Hughes, because he wrote a great script. And so there wasn't those, as often or sometimes happens when you're making a movie and you're running a scene and it's just not playing somewhat, and you have to kind of dig in and find it and rewrite and, you know, just kind of move through all of these things to get the scene right. Now, John's scripts, I mean, they were tight, they were funny. And if you kind of dug into them, you could just make them funnier and funnier. So,
when you came on board, because as you say, John was away while he was shooting Uncle Buck pretty much at the same time as this movie was happening.
I think it was Uncle Buck. I think so.
I'm pretty sure it was Uncle Buck. Did that allow you then to make changes and impose yourself on the script in any way, or did you treat it very much as a sacred text?
Well, that's a good question. I don't remember changing much of it. If I had a question about a scene, I'd just pick up the phone and call John and say, listen, and we would just jam together, and he would go, I wonder if we did it this way, and I would, you know, I wasn't confident in my writing skills. I mean, I've learned to write since, and now am writing and developing, so that is not an issue. But then I wanted to make sure that I was respecting his writing. On the other hand, if anything wasn't playing, you know, I could pick up the phone anytime. Even when he was on set, he would take the call, we would jam it, and I would just adjust it. But I can't remember a single moment where that was happening, but I'm sure it did happen along the way.
Was there much improv on set at all? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of Chevy's incredible rant at the end of the film. I rewatched a film recently with subtitles on, just to see how whether the subtitles could keep up. Yeah, there's a lot of words. The subtitles could not keep up with Chevy. That is for sure. Was that all scripted, or did he chase it up a little bit?
No, scripted to the word. And I remember in that rant that the entire cast, the reverse, because Chevy is there, and Dan are living room, ranting and kind of pacing and ranting. And the whole family on the reverse is there, all 11 of them, how many there were. They all had sandwich boards of the text. So Chevy could like, and so that would enable and help him to recover the lost words from his brain. There's too much to remember. But so that's how he did. He did it great.
That's amazing. I need to now see this on the biggest screen possible and then just pause it frame by frame to see if his eyes are flitting between people. It's beautiful. That's a Marlon Brando technique. I like it.
But yeah. Yeah.
But you have, as you mentioned there, you have an incredible cast in this film. I mean, I don't think we even mentioned Mae Questel and William Hickey.
Yeah, who turn up. That's right, Bill Hickey, sure.
Oh my God, they turn up at the end as sort of comedy bombs. And that's something that actually happens all the way through the movie, Jeremiah, which is because you do the same thing with Cousin Eddie, where you introduce him about half an hour into the movie and you drop him in like a, almost like a comedy hand grenade.
Comic bomb, yeah.
Yeah.
With Bill Hickey, who, you know, I had moved from L.A., from New York to L.A., and Bill Hickey was a legendary acting teacher. This is somebody who, very serious, really kind of amazing influence on New York actors over the years. Mm. Know many who studied with him. I just thought it was the most bizarre choice on my side to get Bill Hickey to play it. You know what I mean? And I'm sure, well, I know he was as surprised to get it, the offer that is, and fly out and do the part. And it like, again, Diane Ladd, you know, these are John Rando. These are serious actors. When you give a serious actress the ability to make comedy, it's great. John Hamm is a great example now. John Hamm is like turns into a great comedic actor no matter what he does. But there's no arguing that he's a great dramatic actor. So, and Mae Questel, it was just, if I can get Betty Boop to be in my movie, you know, the lineage of comic absurdity would like track right up to my set, and had no idea if she could do it and how much support she would need. But oh my God, it was so fun.
I mean, she's just tremendous in the role. The minute she turns up at the house with that voice of hers saying, "Are we at the airport, Clark?" and these glorious non sequiturs, beautiful stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, people watching the movie now, I don't think they know who Aunt Bethany was. They don't know that Mae Questel,
that's a good point,
you know, is very much a lesson for that voice. Betty Boop is like, you know, we're talking about the history of comedic cartoons, you know, over the course of cinema, very, very famous, almost like Mickey Mouse's first early voices, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Steamboat Willie and all of that. Yeah. So I, you know, I was feeling really supported all the way through. I mean, there wasn't these, you know, these moments where it's possible to go, you know, do I have to second guess the studio? Am I going in another direction? Is my producer working against me? Do the actors hate me? No, you know, we were moving in the same direction, and it was exciting for me, obviously, because it was my first movie. Second of all, we were shooting on the Warner's back lot for most of the movie in the spring and summer. So just that was exciting to be on those sound stages where, you know, the kind of history of Warner's films were made, to go on the back lot, build a house or two, to be creating the winter scenes out of sheer cloth. That's very, very exciting for a kind of a newbie director to kind of experience. And so every day was an adventure, as difficult as making a movie is.
Did it put you off Christmas at all, shooting a Christmas movie in the middle of summer?
Not really. I always like to get presents, so... You know what I mean? You can give it to me any time of year, but no, not really.
Was your wrap gift by any chance a subscription to the Jello of the Month Club?
My wrap gift, which is funny you say that, because I've been going through a lot of my archives and storage, as one does in a pandemic, right? Got that extra time. It's like, I think I'll clean my entire office and organize it. I found my wrap gift, which was the very first digital camera.
No way.
Yeah, I still have it. I think it was a Casio.
Uh-huh.
And it had a little mini floppy disk. And it shot, you know, maybe 200 kilobyte shots, hyper pixelated. But I have it.
That was it. That was a wrap gift. That's incredible. There's a lot of things that have lodged in my brain because of this movie over the years. There are things I say, I say that's the gift that keeps on giving the whole year. I say that a lot because of your movie. It also introduced me to Melikalikimaka.
Melikalikimaka, yes.
That great Bing Crosby song.
Yeah, sure.
Where did that come from? Was that something that you brought to the movie, the musical choices that run all the way through it?
Yeah, you know, I worked with, there's a man, Gary Marsh, who died a few years ago. Tremendous man. He ran the music department at Warner's. So, you know, I could pick up the phone and go, Gary, you know, send me 1,000 Christmas songs that we could, you know, we could get the rights to. So I was constantly auditioning while I was shooting, while I was editing, and certainly even in pre-production, I was auditioning a lot of songs. There's many songs that didn't make the cut that I loved, and many that did that I still love. I just, you know, a lot of the choices were a pivot on irony, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You know, Mavis Staples did a tremendous opening song for us, Christmas Vacation.
That was commissioned.
That was commissioned, yeah. And Gary made that happen. I think Prince was the producer of that. And I remember talking, yeah. It was a very, very exciting musical kind of focus. Angelo Badalamenti, who I'd asked to score it, which is like Twin Peaks, dark, brooding. Of course I'm going to ask the counter prevailing wind to score a comedy.
Of course.
But it all worked out because people were – you know, Jerry Greenberg, who had cut, you know, all of these really incredible action movies and classic kind of 70s movies, not known as a comedic cutter, came on and I asked him to cut it. So it was really an interesting, I just took the shot of working with people who, like myself, didn't come right out of the comedic culture, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But we're able to look at it in a different way. I wanted animated opening titles.
Okay.
And I wanted them for a real reason, because I wanted to say to the audience, you're about to watch a cartoon. This is no real people were harmed during the making of this movie. And so I wanted to just set the tonality straight and differentiate it from the original two movies. And Warner's, I remember they said, oh, it's so expensive to do. Do we really need it? We don't need it. It's not just opening titles. And, you know, we're not going to do an animated thing. Just do, you know. And I was like, okay. So what I did was I cut a opening title sequence that looked like it was lifted from a French film right out of the 60s. So it's a black background with white type where, you know, the white type is a little fuzzy and just keeps jumping a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all the titles were in French. Réalisateur, produit par. So it looked like 133. It looked like a French art movie from the 60s. Like you'd come. And I completely fell in love with this approach because it was still a broad comedy. People were going to come to a broad comedy, and then it would open with like a French art film title, and the music I put on it was a version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town, sung by a Jamaican artist who was probably in his 80s and probably didn't have any teeth because it was very mumbly. And it was so good. And I remember Chevy and I were like, I showed it to him. It's like, this is so fantastic.
Oh, my God.
When I showed it to the studio, and I was at that point going like, yeah, who needs an animated? You know how much this opening title cost? Like $2,000 to put together, right? They went like, we think a cartoon opening title is a great idea.
Yeah.
And we'll commission Mavis Staples. And
that's amazing.
I wish I had a copy of that.
I think I need to see that more than anything right now. If you ever do find it.
Yeah, anyway, musical choices are and have been really, really fun for me generally.
Yeah. And so I guess just to go back to Meli Kalikimaka, was that something that was part of that 1,000 song mixtape essentially that you got? And you just thought, oh, this is great. I'll put it in this scene.
Well, of course I wanted a Bing Crosby Christmas song. I mean, I thought that would be the right tone. So I was looking for very specific things. Mm-hmm. You know, when he's in the attic looking at old films, I wanted something, you know, that was more emotional. You know, so I was mixing and matching tonalities to either counterpoint or support what was going on the screen, as one does. Meli Kalikimaka is a popular song. I mean, it's not, you know, may not be that popular in Britain, but in Hawaii, it's very popular. I just thought that doing a Hawaiian chorus sung by Bing Crosby in that particular scene, I just thought had all the trappings of a perfect unity for the movie that I was trying to make.
Especially that scene as well, where it's a fantasy scene. It's the one moment when fantasy really intrudes upon the movie, which is fairly realistic, you know, maybe some slapstick elements aside. The sled ride. Sure. Is perhaps not realistic. I'm guessing, no matter no matter how good that lubricant is, I'm guessing you don't go down the hill that quickly. Just to go back to the idea of the animated titles, setting the audience up for the notion that they're watching a live action cartoon, that comes into play with Chevy, who is so good at slapstick, whether he's on the ladder or whether he's on the roof with the lights or the sled bit, of course, or the planks hitting him in the face.
Well, yeah, the planks, that's a great piece. That was a bit of improv. And by the way, to the point of improv, we always shot the script. And then, of course, we went out there and let the actors run. I mean, all of this stuff from Randy Quaid going, he goes, that's all improv. So the actors really kind of contributed a huge amount as we kind of dressed up. So we'd shoot the script, the book, and then kind of go off on tangents and have fun with it.
So the plank was an idea on set?
No, because I had to do, I wanted, because I was making a comedy, I said, I'm not going to make a comedy unless somebody steps on a board and gets hit in the head. Because I know that was my contribution. And of course, I wanted it to happen several times. That differentiates it somewhat.
Yes.
You know, where he steps on it, it's like, oh, God, yeah. Turns around, steps on it. You know, so it's the triumvirate of comedy, three beats. But that's just a classic comedy trope, right?
Yeah.
Man steps on a board, he gets hit in the head.
Yeah.
It's always funny.
It's always funny.
I don't know why.
It's always funny.
I don't know why.
And one of the most famous jokes of all time is in The Simpsons, which is when Sideshow Bob, I don't know if you're aware of this, but he steps on one rake, gets hit in the head, then steps on another rake, gets hit in the head, then another rake, and it pulls back to reveal that he's in the middle of a whole load of rakes, and it goes on for about a minute. It's just genius. But you prefigure that. You predate that with this, with Clark being hit twice.
Yeah.
So there you go. Hats off. Yeah. Hats off. And Chevy as well, I guess, is someone who is well known for his physical comedy and his prowess of physical comedy, you know, what he did on SNL back in the first season of show.
He's really fantastic instincts for slapstick and physical comedy.
Mm.
I mean, he played Gerald Ford way back when.
Yes.
So, you know, and Gerald Ford was a master at physical comedy, I think.
And I just want to ask as well about Cousin Eddie and Randy Newman's not in this movie, and Randy Quaid as well, because again, that idea that he's a comedy bomb, that he gets dropped into the movie and he's operating on a slightly different level to everyone else. What sort of collaborations did you have with Randy in terms of?
Oh, it was just so fun. I mean, you could just wind him up, let him go, and it was gold, gold, gold. It's funny because Beverly is the straight man to Chevy, and then Chevy's the straight man to Randy.
Yes.
And in a way, Randy's the straight man to Mae Castell and Bill Hickey. So they do change up over the course of the scenes. But with Randy, he loved playing Cousin Eddie. I mean, you could just tell. You could, right? I mean, there's such joy in that performance.
Yeah.
I just remember that I had asked Wardrobe to find a Dickie, right? And with a kind of a translucent, transparent white sweater, so you could actually see the Dickie through. There was something that I thought was a good idea. Well, yeah. When he put it on, he looked at himself and he like it was like comedic armor. you put that on and you walk around that room, and of course you can't go wrong. So working with Randy was a joy, and Randy had. Again, amazing dramatic actor, amazing comedic actor. God knows what he's doing now. I only know what I read in the papers.
Yeah.
But I think he is just brilliant.
He's fantastic. And I love the way that you introduce him as well. You have that lovely shot. It's a really beautiful, heartfelt moment where Clark has finally managed to get the lights to work in the house. And he's receiving the plaudits of his family. Perhaps not his father-in-law, E.G. Marshall. I love that bit where he goes, the lights aren't twinkling. Yeah, thanks for noticing, Art. Thank you for telling me. And then suddenly Cousin Eddie has just shown up. And I love the way you do that. Do you remember why you decided to stage it in that way?
Well, yeah. I mean, in a way, it was, even though, you can't get inside of Chevy's head, but I wanted the audience to have the reveal of Cousin Eddie the way Clark would have the reveal of Cousin Eddie. And so as the camera would move along the patter of the family, it's like, you're not twinkling, Clark, right? That kind of thing. And then as it just kind of moves and we discover a brand new character, and I think he says something like, it's real beautiful or something like that.
Yeah.
And with that, and then the reaction of Chevy to that. So just to have that surprise and then go back to Chevy is like, what happened? And the audience is kind of waiting for it too. You kind of feel that.
Yeah.
And so it was a deliberate way of introducing him in somewhat of a surprising way, though tipped. But allowed him his opening reveal.
It's fantastic. And I've just got to ask you about one last Cousin Eddie moment before I wrap this up, which is Shitter Was Full. What do you remember about shooting that?
Oh, well, it's shot in two different times, really, on the schedule. Mm-hmm. We have the exterior. Mm-hmm. Right, which was just like, holy shit, can you believe what we're doing? Yeah, add more brown to the it was very practical because we get him in wardrobe with the little bathrobe and just the pump, and then like, let's go. And like, you put Randy in that situation, it's so great. He just like, he disappears into the scene. So that's great. Not a lot of work for me, honestly. But on the inside, where I'm shooting them looking at him through the window,
yeah,
And that was done on the inside of the soundstage rather than on the back lot where we shot the Randy part of it. That was a particularly difficult day. There was a lot of tension on the set. Beverly and I were really at each other's throats. Chevy had taken up a sort of a defensive posture for me, and that kind of translated to him fighting with Beverly. And so what I really remember was trying to just tell both of them just to, like, don't worry about it. You know, we can, Beverly and I can fight. It's okay. We'll get through this, but you don't have to come to my defense. And just to calm the actors down. And I don't even know if they remember this, but they were really hostile to each other during the kind of final makeup touch-ups and the lighting. And when they finally got on set, and it was like just steamy. And then as soon as I called action, they just like, right into their characters as if nothing happened, you know, and then cut and they walked away. So I remember it very, very well. It's a scene that I find somewhat disquieting to watch because there was a lot of emotional churn that day. And yet watching the scene, none of it is in the scene. You don't feel that in the scene at all. And that's a tribute to how professional both of them are and were.
Once action's called, put everything to one side. And then once cut's called, that would be an interesting place to be and see what happens. But you do something really interesting in a scene, Jeremiah, as well, which is you, when you cut outside to Cousin Eddie, your camera is, it roves. And there's also that scene where the elder relatives, the Clark and Ellen's mothers and fathers turn up, and you really capture that horror of what it's like when family descends upon you for Christmas and suddenly you have all these relatives saying inappropriate things. And I love the way you cut that scene, and I love the way you have your camera roving in and finding those little moments of comedy and drama. Which again is a different approach from your approach than the rest of the movie. Was that something that you remember exactly what prompted that?
Yeah, I wanted it to be, I wanted to feel somewhat chaotic and a little bit out of control. I think I used sort of a sound story, both musically and sonically, to kind of turn it a little bit sour. Mm-hmm. I wanted to feel somewhat out of control. That was my instinct, that it was all happening too fast.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
What is happening? Yes. Who are these people? Why are they attacking me? And then, you know, button that with the cat in the box.
The cat in the box. Like, oh, my word.
Chevy was really great in that because obviously he's, you know, there's an empty box, right? When we're on, and he was like, that was very improvised and beautifully done.
With just a squealing cat added in post. It's yeah. Wonderful. It's beautiful stuff. So I've got to ask you to wrap this up. I've got to ask you, whenever you saw the film recently with your granddaughter, who is how old, by the way?
Seven.
Okay, so she's okay for this film. That's all good, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Shitter was full, maybe earmuffs for that, but otherwise it's fine.
I think she's heard worse.
I imagine she has. 7 years old, I was saying worse, so yeah, I can imagine. But when you watched the film again, what stood out for you as you were watching it objectively? What were the peaks for you, and were there troughs for you as well? Things that you would do differently?
I think the peaks were really no different than how I felt when I first locked the picture, which was land those emotional moments, even in the complete absurdity of such broad comedy. Make sure that when a moment between two people or between the family, what really creates the family is that emotional need to be part of a family and what that means. And I was hyper-conscious of it when I made the film, when I cut the film, when I screened the film, and then years later, now it's been like 30 years or more, I continue to be happy that those scenes have landed appropriately. You know, are there things that would have been different had we had CG? Maybe, you know, but, you know, that was made then. And, you know, you just plunge in, do your best work, hope for the best. You know, every director will tell you that. I mean, it's not like you get to control everything all the time in a perfect way. You try to make the best movie you have under the conditions you are working in, both physically and financially, and with managing the egos. And when something turns out well, you know, you take full credit for it. But it's not. But really, it's such a, I mean, you know, the contributions of everyone on that team were palpable. So my applaud to my crew and my cast years ago, those who are still remaining with us.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, you did include a clip from It's a Wonderful Life. I wonder, was that you perhaps putting that in as a way of saying, I hope one day my film is also considered to be a classic? Or were you tempting fate or tempting the gods in some way?
More like tempting fate. I think it would... Yeah, never did I expect this to even be mentioned in the same list of a movie like that. But I was conscious that I was making a movie in the tradition of Christmas movies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I would feel, well, if I have a movie on TV, I mean, what is it going to be? You know, is it going to be Die Hard, or, you know, is it going to be something that the family would have been watching? So they would have been watching that, I think.
They would indeed. They would indeed. And on that note, Jeremiah, to paraphrase Clark W. Griswold, you did it. Thanks, sir. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Okay, so that was Jeremiah S. Chechik. The S, I presume, stands for squirrel. Yeah, I can only assume. And now it's time for us to talk about this movie, which I absolutely adore. Where do you guys stand on Christmas Vacation?
It's a corker, isn't it? I think this is Chevy Chase at his best as a leading man. I love him in Three Amigos. That might be my favorite Chevy. But as a guy doing his own thing, as a front man for a film, mm-hmm. I think this is my favorite Chevy. This and Funny Farm, the very underrated Funny Farm.
Really?
It's quite a similar, genuinely good, and quite similar. It's kind of him against the elements.
Right.
Good double bill.
Interesting. Of course, if you're going to, you know, defer to anybody on this, you defer to the author of Wild and Crazy Guys.
Exactly.
A man who has seen more Chevy Chase films than it is surely good for him.
More than Chevy Chase, probably.
Yeah, definitely more than Chevy Chase has seen, or indeed remembers making. This is such a great film. Great performance. Hellspells, where do you stand on it?
I am probably slightly less evangelical than the pair
Get
of you.
Get out!
But not, you know, anti, just slightly less pro. I feel like it's got incredible comic set pieces. I had forgotten some of them, actually. I went back and watched this a couple of days ago, and
that's nice.
Yeah, and I had forgotten the opening, the whole opening bit in the car, actually. Didn't mm-hmm. ring a bell at all. I was like, don't remember this being here, even slightly.
I was thinking about that. I had totally forgotten that the opening 5 minutes of this film rivals any Fast and Furious movie for high-octane car action. I mean, it is absolutely off the hook.
Dual wishes, you know, so there are little bits like that that completely slipped my mind, but equally bits like the lights lighting the house and the squirrel in the tree and cutting open the turkey that have stayed with me ever since I first saw it. I do like it. I think my big problem is, this may be unfair, I don't think his character is entirely consistent. On one hand, he's this kind of Ted Lasso-ish, incredible optimist, this kind of indefatigable, almost innocent. And on the other hand, he's still quite Chevy Chase, and he's quite acerbic at times. And, you know, like that
we
bit
could
where
take multitudes,
the,
Helen. We
I
could
guess
take
he
multitudes.
Does. I guess I'm just not giving him credit.
He's like an extremely horny Mr. Bean, isn't he? Like he's got all the slapstick, but then he's slightly pervy at moments as well. Maybe uncomfortably so.
Oh, very, very pervy at moments, yeah.
But I prefer this model of Chevy Chase performance to, you know, you get two kinds. You get him where everything's going wrong and he's basically just getting hit in the face by a plank, sometimes literally, but sometimes metaphorically. And there are other ones where he's the slick, cool guy.
Yeah.
And they made quite a lot of those with him coming off of SNL. And he's quite unlikable when he's meant to be the cool guy that you want to be. Although I know a lot of people love Fletch.
Oh, Fletcher's great. And seems like old times as well. That great film he made with Goldie Hawn and Charles Grodin and Neil Simon screenplay.
He spends half the movie under a bed. I'm not such a fan of that one.
I really like that film. Although I haven't seen it in years, in fairness. I didn't have to rewatch it whilst I was writing the book. So if I had, I probably would have found my attitude being somewhat discolored. But
it's no Under the Rainbow.
It's no. What's that dreadful one he made with Billy Friedkin? Deal of the Century?
Oh, Deal of the Century. It's okay. It's not dreadful. Okay. It's a curio because it's him being a straight man. Not trying to be funny.
He kind of is that in this. And I think there's a really, you know, I actually was wondering how we could possibly fill out 45 minutes talking about Christmas Vacation, but we're making a pretty good start here. there's not a lot of like thematic stuff to get into, really, I guess. Mm. Well, maybe there is. But, you know, it's kind of interesting in terms of, you're right, Chevy Chase, presenting Chevy Chase in terms of his comedic persona at this point. It was 89 and Fletch Lives came out the same year. And so he was doing the smug thing, but also the kind of homely family man that Clark is in this movie. But it's also an interesting juxtaposition with the previous two Vacation movies. So in European Vacation, he's pretty much full-on buffoon, you know, the typical American idiot abroad who's just absolutely no clue what's going on at any point. He's always got this idea. There's always this idea through the Vacation movies that Clark will do anything for his family and he's driven by that. Yes, this is true. But in Vacation as well, he's a little bit opportunistic. He, you know, is fully up for having an affair with Christy Brinkley's character. A little bit of that is preserved in the horniness with the lingerie saleswoman. Yes. But by and large, this is almost a reset button for the franchise. You know, it's, you know, Cousin Eddie carries over from Vacation. But otherwise, the recasting of the kids each time, I think, means that none of the movies really have take place in the continuity. So this is a reset button on Clark, and they reset him as this kind of wholesome Jimmy Stewart type figure. And it's actually quite interesting for me watching this movie because he's brilliant at all the slapstick stuff. He's brilliant at all the buffoonish stuff because that's what he's great at. But it also showed that he could do straight ahead, straight down the middle, the straight man. You know, as Jeremiah Cechik pointed out, he becomes the straight man in the movie once Cousin Eddie shows up. And then once Aunt Bethany shows up as well, everyone becomes a straight man to her as well. So it's an escalating Russian doll in reverse, but of straight men. But this shows that he could have done so much more in his career. He had more range than I think people were willing to give him credit for. That's a very long-winded way of saying I liked it.
He could have played Forrest Gump, according to Chevy Chase. I've not heard this from anyone else, but he claims that he was offered Forrest Gump and turned it down, which is interesting.
See, that I can't see. I can't see that.
I can't see him with a box of chocolates. He wouldn't be able to open it without falling over, and the squirrel would have got the chocolates immediately off that bench.
Yeah, this is true.
I mean, look, in terms of sheer talent, comic timing, he could play anything. There's no question. But I wonder if he has, and he can play warmth, I guess, here. I think that's what maybe has gotten lost in some of his recent work. I mean, at the start of lockdown, I watched Community again from start to finish, and you know, it's notable how good he is at being like you say, kind of a dickhead, like a smug git in that. But you know, the joke is on him generally because he doesn't have that much to be smug about, as it turns out. But he also plays the emotional beats well when he gets them. I think maybe he was just too difficult for too long a time to have the career he deserved. I think it's not a matter of people not being sure he could play it. I think it's more maybe, you know, and he's, I think, talked about this himself. It's more a case of him being more difficulty than people were willing to put up with.
I think he had other issues as well, didn't he? He had addictions that he had to get past in his career, which made him difficult to hire. When he did try and branch out, for example, with Memoirs of an Invisible Man, it didn't really work. He tried to play a kind of action hero in that, again, very earnest. And I think he, you know, I think John Carpenter said in the past that they were basically taking jokes out of the script, which is not really what you want to do with Chevy Chase. But I think this movie shows that there were more strings to his bow than perhaps the rest of his filmography might suggest.
Yeah, it was kind of his last huge hit, I think. It was the last true mega hit for Chevy Chase and the last kind of defining thing, which is a shame because it's really fun. It must have felt like a huge comeback when it came out, but it didn't really go anywhere. He had his ill-fated TV show. Check out an episode. Amazing. And yeah, I don't know. I just feel like this performance gets the, it's a blend of the two sides of him that people, yeah, that he can kind of do well, where he's the buffoon, he's the moron, but then also you get these little flashes of him saying hilarious things. And, you know, that scene with his boss where he's saying, kiss my ass, kiss his ass, mm-hmm, kiss your ass. It's great. People love him because he's the wise ass like that. And you get little flashes of some amazing one-liners in this.
Yeah. But that, I mean, that's the one that didn't really fit for me with Clark Griswold. Do you know what I mean? That felt more like Chevy Chase, and that's great, but it didn't feel quite in keeping with the rest of the character. It didn't feel like that guy would hang up 25,000 lights on his house.
Well, maybe that's the anger coming out. Not to get too deep into Clark Griswold. This is turning into like a you know, a deep psychoanalysis of Clark Griswold. But, you know, this is a guy who tries. That's like his defining quality, is he tries his absolute hardest all the time to pull off the... Everything has to be perfect. And obviously it never is. So he's going to get angry and he's going to occasionally lash out and probably kill. We don't see it on screen, but there are bodies in that garage. You know, he's got his mask on.
He does. The key to Clark, I think, is that he's insane.
Right.
And he's insane at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
And the mask he puts on all the way through the movie is of Mr. Domestic, Mr., you know, Mr. Domesticated, Mr., you know, Husband of the Year, Mr. Father of the Year. But he's absolutely, pathologically, certifiably insane right from the beginning. That's why he drags his family out into the middle of nowhere to take a massive Christmas tree. It's why he takes all these completely nutty risks with the tree, cutting the tree inside the house, and, you know, and slowly but surely the mask slips. So that's why I'm going to read Clark in this, that he's insane from the off. If you want to say that this is a continuation of the previous two movies, he's insane from the off and he slowly unravels. And so it's the real Clark who says, you know, kiss my ass, kiss his ass, kiss your ass, right, happy Hanukkah. That's the real Clark. The real Clark is the guy at the end who does the absolutely incredible rant about Frank Shirley. And it kind of makes a little bit of sense once you see, you know, the rest of the family.
This is one of those Clark Kent Superman situations, like, as discussed in Kill Bill. Okay.
Yes. So the whole Friday the 13th bit is suddenly making sense because I never understood that bit. It's so weird.
He's killed before, he'll kill again, he's letting the mask slip. Todd and Margot, and I have to say, you know, I love this movie, but those bits have never worked for me. The bits with Nicholas Guest and Julia Louis-Dreyfus have never worked for me. They're so clunky, but, you know, I didn't bring that up with Jeremiah, it's judging for obvious reasons. They're really clunky, Jeremiah, and I think you could have done better there. They're only, I think, useful in terms of showing what other people think of Clark, in a way. But also, you know, that's Julia Louis-Dreyfus in a movie when she was young. What the hell's going on? And then, oh my God. And then you realize, you do a bit of deep dive and realize that's Christopher Guest's brother as well.
Ah. I think they're funny. I love an 80s movie yuppie couple. Why not? I think they're great. That's so much hair wax on him. He is highly flammable.
And so much body on her. My God, the hair, I mean. It's
yes,
enormous.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yes, oh my word. It's another one. It's interesting because I don't like Home Alone at all. And I think I've said this in the podcast before. I've certainly said it on Twitter. But this is the latest in a long line. Clark W. Griswold is the latest in a long line of John Hughes protagonists who are, you know, upper middle class, doing very, very well. And yet, he's not punchable in the way that I think Kevin is in Home Alone.
Oh my God, he's a child.
I'm completely on the side of Harry and Marv all the way through. He's not punchable in the way that Ferris Bueller, who has been reincarnated as Stephen Miller, is in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He's not punchable in that way. You know, even Kevin's dad in Home Alone, who's clearly up to his neck and no good. How can you afford that house? You know, but we're somehow on Clark's side all the way through, despite that.
Yeah, he's much more likable than Neil, the Steve Martin character in Planes, Trains, who also has a really epic, you know, tantrum, breaks at one point and starts screaming and dropping F-bombs. But he is likable.
Yeah, because you do believe that he just wants the best for his family. Like that, you do believe that all the way through, and in a way that you maybe don't of particularly Steve Martin in Planes, Trains, Automobiles.
And it's, you know, it's subverting that sort of thing. I think someone calls him the last true family man at one point. And, you know, you get, how many movies do you get where everything's perfect at Christmas and it looks effortless? And it's kind of, the movie is saying, well, that's not true. That's just like that's a myth that it can be like this, that actually it's a lot harder. And they're showing this guy's torment at trying to live up to that, like, ideal.
The only thing is, and not to get on my regular horse about this, most of the labor of making Christmas perfect generally falls on women.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
okay.
Most of the labor of making sure, you know, the perfect food is done, most of the present buying, most of the card sending.
Helen, you've never tried my eggnog.
But a lot of that is generally done by women. And so, you know, when you make, I don't know, if you're making a man the center of that particular story, it just, maybe this is just what Hollywood does.
Is it saying that men are rubbish at it?
But he's not doing any of that. That's all getting done. Presumably.
Oh, he's not involved with that, but still, no. Because Catherine, Cousin Eddie's wife, does the turkey, that's because, you know,
that's
it's because she's just a car wreck of a human being. Mm. But, you know, that's why that goes terribly wrong. But by and large, I think you're right. Ellen in this movie is the calm, stoic center at the heart of everything, at the heart of the storm that is Clark. And, you know, Jeremiah Chechik said basically that, you know, during the filming of it, Beverly D'Angelo wasn't that happy with what she had to do in the movie.
Yeah.
And she is not really given an awful lot to do in the film. I think that's, this one focuses on Clark more than any of the previous films and doesn't really give her any great comedic bits of business, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I mean, she's literally sort of being supportive. She figures out the light thing, I guess, which is the closest this film gets to breaking my heart, when he's put all this effort into putting up these lights all over the house, and then he gathers everybody in for this big unveiling and they don't go on. Like, that genuinely does, I find it quite tough to watch. but she kind of figures out what's wrong and solves that problem eventually. But other than that, I mean, what does she really get to do?
She has a lovely moment with her mother, and the film is really good at the sort of frustrations of Christmas and how terrible it is having relatives in your house, and, you know, how awful they all are when they come over, and they, you know, you have your routine and then suddenly here they are snoring and asking you inappropriate questions and all sorts. So she has a lovely moment in the kitchen where she's with Audrey and she starts lighting up a cigarette in frustration because it's all too much, and her mother has some sort of sixth sense from the next room, goes, Ellen, are you smoking in there? And her frustration of that is really fun. But by and large, she is there to tut and raise an eyebrow and to be the voice of reason.
Yeah,
which is a shame. But, you know, everything else is so damn funny, guys, that I find myself focusing on that. And when I said this to the director as well, I said this to Jeremiah Chechik, when I first saw this movie, I was drawn towards all the slapstick stuff. And I still am to an extent when I rewatch this movie, which is once every year, July 31st, like clockwork. Really,
no,
really see in Christmas,
idiot.
Right?
You got to watch it on June the 20th.
I've gone full Cousin Eddie. What am I doing? But whenever I watch this movie, I still think the sled going down the hill. I remember where I was when I watched this movie for the first time, and I remember losing it, like uncontrollable laughter. I missed the next 3 to 4 minutes of the movie because I was laughing so hard at that. Thank God I was watching it on VHS, I could rewind it back. But
that's the dream, isn't it? When you're a kid, you just want to get on an amazing toboggan or whatever and just pelt it down a hill. I used to get bin bags at school. I don't know why I'm talking about this, but we used to get black bin bags and go up to the steepest hill and then go down. But nothing was as awesome as watching them do it in this film. Like, it's just the ultimate. You want to do it, and also it's terrifying.
Yeah, they kind of riff on that a little bit in Godmothered recently. I think it's become a bit of a thing, but I was wildly jealous. We had very small hills in my town, very small, and it just wasn't enough to kind of go on a sort of 6-foot rise.
They had a lot of trouble with the snow filming this. I think it was like a Die Hard 2 situation where they had to just keep moving around and they'd get somewhere with loads of snow and then it would melt overnight and then they'd have to like pick up everything, load the trucks and go somewhere else and then that would melt and they were having an absolute nightmare with it. But it was worth it because it has got glorious snow. And I think they filmed it in summer as well. So
they did,
the street is all fake snow because it was actually swelteringly hot.
Oh my goodness.
Movie magic, folks. Movie
do you guys
magic.
Get excited that the house from Lethal Weapon is next door to theirs?
Is it?
It's Murtaugh's house from Lethal Weapon. They filmed on the same street.
Oh my goodness.
At Warner Brothers.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So it's the Christmas street.
It is indeed. If you listen carefully, you can hear a sax solo just occasionally drifting from that house.
That would have been amazing. Instead of Todd and Margot, it would have been Roger Murtaugh and his wife. They could have done that. This could have been the pre-MCU. This could have been the first shared universe.
That would have been amazing. Can you imagine the tree comes through the window and he just shakes his head and goes, I'm too old for this shit.
I'm too old for this shit. He stalks over to Clark's house and he shoots him and goes, you know, just been revoked.
I'm too old for this squirrel.
I'm too old for this Christmassy shit. That'd have been amazing.
I gotta say, I have a special appreciation for this film as one of the few people who has been subject to a squirrel attack in their own home.
That's true. Yeah, this is absolutely true.
This is not a comedy for me. This is real life, and this is a documentary. I was living in Finsbury Park, and one Sunday morning, I woke up at like 7 a.m. or something, uncharacteristically early, and I'm hearing this scrabbling around in my room, and I was like, "What the hell is happening?" And a squirrel jumped on the end of my bed, and then back off again, and then ran off elsewhere in the flat, and there was a squirrel. It come through the window.
Oh my God. And it was scrabbling? I didn't even know they could read, let alone play board
games.
They
were pretty basic three-letter words, but it was,
but
it was doing its best.
You can win with three-letter words, you know? Get the right letter on the right triple word score, you're sorted.
It was all like nut, twig.
Food, feed me.
kill. Yeah. This happened. This happened. So I relate to Clark, and it is a terrifying ordeal.
I think we all relate to Clark, don't we? Apart from the people who don't. But, you know... It would be worrying if we related to Cousin Eddie.
Yeah, that would be...
I mean, how do you guys feel about the whole Randy Quaid thing? Like, can you still enjoy a Randy Quaid performance at this point?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if anything, it's enhanced.
I mean, yeah, he's if anything, made himself look more like a method actor than he perhaps once did.
I don't see this as National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I see this as a prequel to Cousin Eddie's Island Adventure. That's what this is. It's like, get past this boring Clark W. Griswold shit. Get to Cousin Eddie. There we go. Half an hour in. Thank you. That's what we're waiting for. Every time you use a microwave, you piss in his pants. That's what we want.
Before we get back to Cousin Eddie, like one of the great triumphs of this film is that they managed to spell Griswold right in the credits, which is something they do not do in European Vacation.
They don't, do they? On the passports.
No, I interviewed Matty Simmons, producer of European Vacation, and I asked him about the fact Griswold is spelt wrong, and he didn't know. No one had ever mentioned it to him before.
Oh, no.
And it was one of those awful interview situations where he just sounded really like crestfallen. He was like, really? And then he looked it up and he was like, oh. But they spell it Griswold with an A, and then in this film it triumphantly is restored to O status.
Quite right.
This is only interesting to pedants like me, so I apologise for bringing this up.
No, that's huge for me, because that throws me every time I watch European Vacation. So every time I watch it, I have to burn my copy in disgust, then I have to buy another copy. It's a really expensive hobby. I can absolutely enjoy Randy Quaid performance now, even though, you know, he's experiencing difficulties, shall we say.
Yes, he has.
But he's fantastic in this. He's, as I said to Jeremiah Jetchik, he's like a comedy hand grenade that's just thrown into the movie. I love the way he's introduced. I love the way that, you know, Clark, who's finally had a moment of triumph, is walking along the line of his family members, getting a little bit of shade thrown at him by E.G. Marshall. And my God, what a cast this movie has. We'll get that in a second. And then there's just, I don't know, Cousin Eddie and Catherine. And I love Chevy Chase's double take in this moment. It's just so good. You know, the way they're already mid-conversation and he's like, hang on a second, Eddie? Catherine? What the hell? It's a masterclass in comedic acting.
Mm. And it is, I mean, it's over the top and it's ridiculous and, you know, social services should definitely be called for those poor children. But, you know, within the context of the movie, it's perfect.
Yeah, and he's so good. He's so much funnier in this movie than he was in National Lampoon's Vacation, for me, anyway. Mm. And so much more memorable. I don't know whether it's because of the ridiculous get-ups that he has, that lovely sweater that he has when he knocks over when he's drinking the eggnog, and the way his hair has got the sort of Superman, the forelock, the S-curl on his hair that's been brill-groomed within an inch of his life. I don't know whether it's that or whether the fact that he's just so brilliantly written. It's very, very hard to write stupid so well, I think. But there's little things like the moment where they're it's the night before Christmas, which I believe is called Christmas Eve, and Clark's going, hey kids, I hear that Santa's sleigh has been spotted, and all the kids get really excited, and then Cousin Eddie just goes, you serious, Clark? It's just like, just glorious stuff.
It's just the best incarnation of the nightmare guest, like just someone you don't want when you're trying to make everything perfect and you've got this absolutely insane person turning up and just there's no controlling him at all. I really want to see Cousin Eddie's Island Adventure. Is that what it's called? Island Adventure? I've not seen that one.
It's I think it's officially called National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation 2, Cousin Eddie's Island Adventure.
Oh my goodness.
Wow. It was written by Matty Simmons. I wonder how he spelled Griswold in the script.
How does he spell Cousin Eddie?
Yeah, precisely. It's also, I've never seen it. I will say I've never seen it, but it is the first and the only vacation movie in which a Griswold child reprises their role. Ooh. So Dana Barron, who played Audrey in European Vacation, comes back to appear in this one as well.
That's a stunning fact. A stunning fact indeed. I hope the island is Alcatraz. I haven't seen it, but I just hope the film is him in a cell. It's where he belongs. I've got a stunning fact.
This is
a massive tangent away from where we are, so I apologize. But the truck you see at the beginning of this film that tailgates the Griswolds and causes them some trouble on the road is the same truck that Kurt Russell drives in Overboard. And I'm not finished with this fact. This is about to get more stunning. That truck is also in They Live.
Whoa!
What?
It's the same truck.
Recycling, guys.
Recycle.
Yeah, explains that line of dialogue.
explains a bit where Clark finds a magical sunglasses that lets him see all the aliens.
This film might be set in the same universe as They Live. That would be amazing. That would explain some stuff.
Is this headcanon now? Is this what the kids call it, headcanon?
I feel like this is more Patton Oswalt's filibuster, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But hey-ho. Enough of me banging on about this movie. What do you guys like about it? Or not like about it? I can take criticism of it, but if you criticize it, you're dead to me.
I was just going to ask, I mean, do we think these are the definitive Griswold kids? They're certainly the most famous pairing, right?
Anthony Michael Hall is in European Vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Ethan Embry is in Vegas Vacation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, in Vacation, which is actually brilliant, if you haven't seen the kind of reboot/sequel, then we're talking Ed Helms and Leslie Mann. So
no, but the kids.
Yeah, I mean the kids.
Yeah, Rusty and Austria. Yeah. Okay, fine.
But Johnny Galecki, famous of course because he's in Roseanne, and then Juliette Lewis.
Yeah,
famous for being Jeffrey Lewis's daughter. So yes, I'm all in on this.
That's what they're famous for.
That's what they're famous for?
Do you know anything else that they're famous for? Name one other project that Johnny Galecki or Juliette Lewis are famous for.
Whip It.
I beg your pardon. It's a different podcast,
kind of,
Helen.
It's not that kind of podcast.
My word. Oh my God.
Oh boy.
What else are they famous for? Give me one thing.
What? Big Bang Theory.
California with a K.
Mm. All right. Okay. Accepted. Accepted. Challenge accepted.
I think they're the definitive kids. Yeah, I'm just going to say yes. I haven't got strong views, but I don't think there's any beating them.
Weirdly, Rusty's younger in this than he is in National European Vacation.
I don't think continuity was a major feature with respect to the kids.
It blew my mind in talking to Jeremiah S. Chechik that he admitted that he had never seen Vacation or European Vacation. And still hasn't.
He still hasn't.
I wonder if it's like William Friedkin. We're talking about him a lot in this podcast, but he refuses to see French Connection 2. Just won't watch it. Just won't. He's like, it can't be any good. It's going to be a terrible film. And he's like, no, it's really good, Billy. You should check it out. No, shit. Okay. It's like talking to James Dyer, but with better hair.
He has got quite good hair, actually.
Billy Friedkin, he really does.
Yeah, that kind of shows you the level of attention to detail that they're trying to do between films in the franchise. I love the director that hadn't seen the previous ones. I wonder if he's seen Island Adventure. Might be a favourite.
He probably watches that every Christmas. Yeah, no problem. Mm.
He's only seen two films, Benny and June, which of course he directed, and Cousin Eddie's Island
and California
Adventure.
With a K. If we're talking about like great scenes or memorable scenes, the scene with the cat in the box with Chevy Chase, that is a genius bit of kind of physical comedy. There's some amazing Chevy Chase physical comedy in this film.
I think he really
brings it, like properly brings it. Full strength. And the scene where he's like miming that there is this crazy animal inside a box and there's nothing in there is just, it's magical. It's amazing. Yeah, there's a lot of animal based kind of slapstick.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not that up on the dog and the squirrel chase at the end. I think it's a bit like one of those blockbusters where it's, you know, the film's coming to an end and now there's just throwing in another action sequence, another exploding skyscraper just for the sake of it. You don't need that necessarily. You've already had the Christmas tree exploding. With the cat being electrocuted, I forgot to mention this to Jeremiah S. Chechik because I really wanted to ask him about it, but I forgot because I'm an idiot. But the sound effect of the Christmas tree being turned on, the flames from the electric short circuiting flying towards the cat, which is off screen, and all you hear is a is hilarious to me.
It's haunting.
It's haunting, but hilarious.
Yeah. did Jeremiah S. Chechik tell you the story about the squirrel?
No.
How they did the squirrel story. So basically, it's kind of hilarious. They spent weeks training this squirrel to do exactly what it needed to do. They're very hard to train, but they had a team working on it, using snacks to motivate the squirrel and getting all the moves down. And then finally, the day arrives for them to do the squirrel scene, and the squirrel dies on the day.
Sorry.
They're just about to record it. There's a dead squirrel. So they're like, oh my God, like, what are we going to do? We have to do the scene. And a member of the crew apparently just turned up a couple of hours later with a squirrel, and no one asked him where he got it. And they just put the squirrel into the scene and shot whatever it did. You don't get the highly choreographed scene that they were going to do. They just do some quick cuts, but I mean, poor squirrel.
Remember when we did that event and we had an animal panel and I, for some reason, hosted it despite never having had a pet in my life? Anyway, so one of the things they actually talked about was squirrels, because they trained a bunch of squirrels for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And they said, essentially, if you want to be really sure of a squirrel doing something it's been trained to do, you need to be training it from birth. So they had had, one of the trainers I was talking to had had basically a wall of cages of baby squirrels in her room for months before that film was made, because she had to basically rear them all by hand, like feed them with little droppers in order to train them to crack nuts like they did in that film. So what you needed was more squirrels.
Probably. I thought they were CG in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I've got to admit.
They were partly CG, but they also used real squirrels.
Interesting. Okay.
Bloody hell.
The more you know.
There we go. The sad story of the Christmas Vacation squirrel.
R.I.P. squirrel. I wish I had asked Jeremiah S. Chechik about it, but I'm not a big fan of the squirrel bit, so I didn't ask. But I would have robbed you of your moment of glory, Nick. What an incredible story.
Incredible story. Badly told.
I think
should
be on
a good story.
Freaking Parkinson with that story, with that anecdote.
I think he's won the fact minutes. Section this week. I don't think there's any need for us to do it in the regular podcast.
All I've got is squirrel stories. I've got nothing else, but I've got squirrel stories.
What stands out for you? I mentioned a great cast earlier on, and it genuinely is like you get E.G. Marshall turning up, then you get Diane Ladd turning up, then you get Mae Castell turning up, and William Hickey, and on top of the embarrassment of riches that we already have with Bloke from Roseanne and Woman from California, it's it's all happening in this movie.
Brian Doyle Murray as well.
Oh my God, yeah. I love a bit of Brian Doyle Murray. He's so great in everything. I kind of wish he'd got a leading role at some point. I know he's not quite the right kind of look or whatever, or he wasn't the right age, but he's so great in this. I love that he's got a Mr. Shirley has like an entourage that just walks around the office with him for no reason. I mean, what is he paying them for? Like, what are they doing? But that's so great, like this phalanx of yes men who are marching around. I love that scene.
Nick, you have the same phalanx.
I do. You were fired from it. You weren't sufficiently obsequious.
I wasn't, because you were rubbish at it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, COVID's really, really put a crimp in that, but you managed to move them into your house, I understand, and they follow you around from the kitchen to the living room.
They're right here. Hang on. Cup of tea.
Right
here. Cup of tea.
Agree with me.
They've gone again. Very hard.
Brandon Murray's great. Brandon Murray has always looked the same age. He looked the same age then as Bill Murray looks now.
He hasn't aged since 1976. I mean, he could be, in this film, he could be any age between 22 and 64. He is ageless and amazing. I love Brian Doyle Murray. He always improves the film.
I also quite enjoy that he has this sort of trophy wife-looking wife who turns up to obviously rescue him from his kidnappers, or at least to talk to the police as they rescue him from his kidnappers. And then she basically, like, rips him a new one and just like has it just completely condemns him for daring to cut his employees' bonuses while she's standing there like draped in mink. And I like that, because it would have been such an easy joke to have her be the bitch. He has this change of heart and she's like, no, you shouldn't do this. We need the money for the mink. And instead they absolutely go the other way. And I kind of enjoy that.
I also really enjoyed the SWAT team leader going, "That's a real shitty thing to do, mister. If I had a hose, I would beat you with it." I was like, no, easy, easy. Also, there's a bit of comedic business for Beverly D'Angelo in that scene. Mm. If you remember,
yes.
Whenever everyone is told to freeze, she has her hand, for some reason, on Clark's crotch.
That's right.
And when she takes her hand off to shake Frank Shirley's hand, I think it's Frank Shirley's hand, she takes it off to shake someone else's hand anyway, and then she replaces it back on Clark's crotch. Yeah. That's worth it.
Glorious.
That's it. That's the glorious moment. You know, it's just mwah, chef's kiss of a joke. It's glorious. Great stuff.
I don't think we've given enough praise to John Hughes. I mean, he gets praise all the time from everyone, but I mean, it's a John Hughes script, and some of the lines are so gloriously, like, you know, you get a funny line, but it just has that weird twist on it that you go, what? Yeah. Like, there's a line early on where they're out in the cold, and the daughter says, "I can't, Mum, I can't feel my hips." And it's just the word hips. It's like such an odd, you know, I can't feel my hands or I can't feel my legs, but something about picking the word hips really made me laugh out loud. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But it's got that weird eccentricity to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you talked early on about the idea that, you know, that Clark sometimes shows different facets of himself. And I think my theory about him being insane is a little overamped, obviously, but there's, I think sometimes the real Clark does peek through, and there's that moment where he takes Eddie to, it might be the eggnog, actually. It might be the eggnog scene. I forgive me for not being terribly specific with this, but there's a lovely scene where he's talking to Cousin Eddie, and he's saying, "Is there anything I can get you, Cousin Eddie? You know, drink some food, drive you out in the middle of nowhere, leave you for dead." And that's the real Clark coming through in those little moments of acerbicness, you know, the kiss my ass, kiss your ass, kiss his ass, happy Hanukkah. That's the real Clark showing through, you know, for me in those moments. I love little things like that. Or the moment where he's, hugging Ellen of a morning. She's going, "Oh, what are you looking at?" "Oh, the silent majesty of a winter's morn." And that asshole in his bathrobe emptying a chemical toilet into our sewer. It's so good, those moments.
Yeah. Yeah, that bit is really good. I also like that anytime the film does get cute and sentimental, it generally undercuts itself. So you have him stuck in the attic for a start, which you could tell the moment he went up there, you're like, well, he's definitely going to get stuck here for some reason, even though surely attic doors open both ways. But anyway, he's stuck. He gets out the old videos or the old tape of his family. He starts watching these Christmases past, gets bathed in the warm glow of nostalgia, and then falls out through the floor.
maybe
I remembered it was coming, but you know it's coming, there's going to be something, but the film never lets him really savor the moment.
A lovely scene. Yeah, that is the attic scene is really lovely when he's looking at the stuff, and it's genuinely sweet because that scene is kind of an Alan Partridge episode, almost, like he's just an idiot who's got stuck somewhere. But it goes to that place that Alan Partridge never would, where you kind of suddenly go, like he's got some heart, and you suddenly feel really warm towards him, and then he's an idiot again, and it's gone. But it's, I think Chechik does a brilliant job with the tone of the movie. It swings around, and he's like got quite tight control of the tone at all times. Yeah, I mean, the scene where he's hanging off, he tends to get stuck in some really ridiculous places. And in the case of him hanging off the roof, he could easily drop. It's like 4 foot into a bush. And yet he hangs off there for, I don't know, I just noticed this time that is a ridiculous place for a man to get stuck.
I love that scene with the lights and falling off and hanging off the roof, and, you know, the shard of ice shattering Todd and Margot's expensive stereo. That'll serve you right. You know, I mean, you clearly earn about as much as Clark does, but we're on his side, that is for sure. And you, speaking of undercutting stuff, Helen, the end where it could all be sentimental, and then you have this weirdness with Aunt Bethany leading everybody in a grand rendition of the Pledge of Allegiance. And it's so weird and undercuts that sentimentality and schmaltiness. Mm.
Yeah, it does. It does feel a little bit weird in its attitude to commercialism, you know, with the next door neighbors, because, you know, all of their stuff gets trashed, pretty much all of their stuff at all times. And there is an element of, oh, well, they deserve it because they're yuppies and they just want all the fancy things. And
they're modern and flashy, and look how cold their home is compared to the Griswolds.
But then, I mean, the Griswolds also want, you know, the flashy things and literally a swimming pool, which is not unflashy.
But Clark has earned it because he has come up with this coating for cereal that locks in the flavor and stops the milk from making it limp.
So
I love that. They still haven't really properly done that with cereal. I eating by be eating
legitimately
frosties
good invention.
They had that. legitimately good invention. And I also do worry as well, you know, sometimes you watch the movie and you think, okay, it's all based around this idea of him getting this Christmas bonus. Mm. How much is that Christmas bonus? Like, realistically, how much is it? Because he wants to put in a swimming pool, which ain't cheap. And then he says, if there's enough left over after all of this, I'm going to fly you all out for the opening of the swimming pool. What the fuck? And the amount of money he's just shelling out in this movie, like windows are being shattered left, right and center. Christmas trees are knocking over everything. He's buying Cousin Eddie's stuff. How much? This guy's fucking minted.
He's getting paid.
He's put $7,500 down on the pool, hasn't he? So it must be at least as much again, if not more.
Wow. Yeah, he's getting real paid.
Mm. He's getting real, real paid. So yeah, to get your bonus from the previous year and add 20%. I mean, what was your bonus from Empire this year, Nick? I imagine it was in the same region. My bonus, I had the same thing where I had to add 20% to my bonus from last year, which is 20% of nothing is nothing. So
yeah. I had a reverse bonus. I had to pay £10 to apply to see if I had a bonus, and then I didn't have a bonus, so it was a $9.99 charge.
On that note, that is it. It's a fairly short spoiler special, this one, but I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoyed the interview with Jeremiah S. Chechik. This is the last of our mini batch of Christmas-related spoiler specials. You will have already heard Love Actually. Coming in the new year, we have Wonder Woman 1984, hopefully with the director Patty Jenkins, and Soul with directors Pete Docter, Kemp Powers, and producer Dana Murray, and many, many more coming as well. Why am I telling you this? You already subscribe. But anyway, do tell your friends, spread the word. But until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, until then, it is goodbye from Red Liver Lips himself, old Nick Dissemblian.
Stay warm, folks, because it's a bit nipply out.
Oh, God.
I mean, that seems problematic now, but that's some world-class punnage wordplay going on from Chevy Chase there.
Strong.
You know, strong stuff. Strong, if problematic. It is goodbye from Tree Squirrel herself, Helen O'Hara.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, everybody. And it's goodbye from me, Mel E. Kamaka.
Great song.
Mel E. Kalimaka.
Kalikimaka.
Mel E. Kalikimaka. Okay. And it's goodbye from me, Mel E. Kalikimaka. I'm off to go to the toilet. I really, really, really desperately hope that the shitter is not full. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.